Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program titled The Mississippi Civil Rights Movement, 1960 to 1964. Our speaker is author James Marshall. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University Professor of History and African American Studies, John Thornton.
I'm really happy and honored, in fact, to introduce my colleague and friend, James Marshall. I met Mr. Marshall, as I recall, in 2010 at the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute, now the Hutchins Center at Harvard, where I was doing a sabbatical and writing a book, and he was writing a book. And this is where I learned about him, and I was like blown away by the kind of experience that he's had and he brings to us. This is a really important moment, I think, in the country, and there's probably no more cogent issue than the civil rights movement. I mean, it's a perpetual topic to talk about in an academic setting, but right now it also has great relevance to us in our country. And so he's had the experience of being able to see an earlier crisis, and now we get to live through another one. So anyway, the core of his story is that Mr. Marshall, from 1963 to 66, was active in the civil rights movement in the South and also in New York City. He was actually a sort of a journalist for Yale's paper. And so he could produce credentials and allowed him to talk to people. And he got to interview a lot of people. Nobody knew who was going to be famous in those days, but he managed to hit a lot of people who were quite famous. And not only that, but he kept pretty detailed notes and transcripts of what he said and did. And that, his experience, his personal experience in the movement, his journalistic interest in everybody else, gave him an amazing collection of stuff. But he didn't stop there. Actually, after he went, he finished in the U.S., he went and got a master's degree in American Studies from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And he wrote an MA thesis, this was quite some time ago, on that. And then that's how he became associated with Hutchins Center. And so this ultimately resulted in his first book, Student Activism and Civil Rights in Mississippi, Protest Politics and the Struggle for Racial Justice, 1960 to 1965. And this is where he really deployed two lines of research. One of them was his own personal experience, because not only did he interview people at the time, but he also did like follow-up interviews over the years, sometimes with the same people, to get more depth in the stories, to see how people were thinking about it later on. And for this present project, he took the second track of that, which is he went and looked at the actual documents from the period, at the Kennedy Library primarily, and this is why his current book, which is The Mississippi Civil Rights Movement and the Kennedy Administration, 1960 to 1964, History and Documents. In here, he has published some of the original documents that he generated himself during his interviews, and documents produced by the Kennedy Administration people that were not available to the public at the time and have only become available over the course of the years. In the Kennedy Library. So this is a person who has like amazing credentials to talk about this topic, and I'm going to start up now and let James Marshall speak to you.
Okay. The new book, as John said, is a collection of documents. What I collected by interviewing people in 63 to 66 and afterwards. Now, if you know the name Bob Moses, who was one of the early activists in Mississippi, in Southwest Mississippi, I had talks that he gave, and that's in there, in this new book, a talk he gave in 1963 at what had gone on in Southwest Mississippi. But I had been abroad, and when I came back in 1990, I sat down with Bob for 5 hours, and we talked about it. What had it been? And what I had done in my research, and whether my research was accurate. And he gave me heads up on what I had found. That's 1990. We're going from 1963, 64, 65, all the way up to 1990, and what I had done abroad as a thesis in 1975, I had been told, no, you can't do that as a book and publish it here unless you've read everything that everybody else has read and written. So I did that, and that's where I met John at Harvard as a fellow. Because I had to sit down with everything that had been written about the Mississippi Civil Rights Movement from 1975 up to 2010. And that's what I sat down and did in my fellowship. And then I put it together as a book. But books, monographs that historians write are really functions of what the historian thinks. His lessons from what happened. But is it what really went on? And that became a question for me after the book came out in 2013. There were things that I didn't have answers for. Where did I find the answers? I found the answers in the Kennedy Library. And that's where the Mississippi Civil Rights Movement and the Kennedy administration came from. A comparison of what I found as a scholar doing research from my experience with documentation and interviewing people. And it was not just Bob Moses, but it was Marion Barry, who had been an early chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and people down in Mississippi, like Aaron Henry, and it goes on and on, a number of people. As an undergraduate, I interviewed some 15 people in Mississippi, in Georgia, in Washington, in New York, and not just using the files that were available from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, I also used the files from the Congress of Racial Equality because I worked with them in the summer of 64, actually the winter and summer of 1963-64, and I worked and I had those documents as well. So this book that came out is a book that examines the documents to try to get answers to questions that we were looking for. Civil rights activists were saying, why weren't there, for example, hearings held, public hearings, by the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights as to what was going on in the South, not just on Mississippi? Well, there's a problem with hearings. If you know anything about government, you saw it now with the hearings in the Senate, right? Well, the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee was James Eastland. He was the head of it. And who was he? He owned a plantation in Mississippi, in the Delta. And if you wanted to get a judge approved, you needed his approval. Otherwise, it wouldn't get out of the Senate. Does that remind you of what went on now? That's what it is. And when LSU Press did the cover for the book, does that remind you of anything? What about the colors? Any of you seen Mississippi Burning? It's like a fire. Okay. Now, if you read along with me quietly, you'll see that's a road which was very dangerous. We'll get to a picture of the Delta, but it goes up into the Delta. It's a photograph taken by one of the movement people, Danny Lyon. Most of these photographs in the presentation were done by Danny Lyon. And Yazoo, if you read about slavery at some point, you're going to know that most of the companies that transferred slaves from the Upper South to the southwestern part of the South, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, Texas, had the name Yazoo in them. Now, Yazoo is in the southwest corner of the Delta, and we'll get to that. But as civil rights workers, we were warned never to go into Yazoo. Extremely dangerous place. The people who were able to get along were people who were white, not people of color. And Yazoo is not a pleasant place, even today. This is the first book that I wrote, and this photograph is on the steps of the courthouse of the worst registrar in the state of Mississippi. But the picture took place in 1964, when the movement had already caused certain things to happen so that they could dare to be on the courthouse steps. We'll come back to it later. Here's the Delta. You see it circled in red. And Yazoo County is in the southwest part of where that southeast part of where the Delta starts. Yazoo and the Delta is the major cotton producer at that time in the United States. Now, anybody have any idea what cotton had to do with the development of the United States as an industrial power? The Industrial Revolution happened as a result of spinning the cotton and selling the cloth abroad. And where was the industrialization taking place? In the North. They said they had nothing to do with slavery. Well, physically, probably not. Not in the North, not that much, but there was there in any case. And that's the Delta. How did people live in the Delta? Well, look at that. In 1965, when I was down interviewing in Mississippi, I was taken around by somebody who was in the Sharecroppers Association, taken up into the Delta. I look at that cabin. No water, no plumbing. This is the way people were living. This photograph was taken by the movement, the same Danny Lyon, in the 1960s. And when we were there, the guide who was taking me through the Delta asked questions of the people what they were eating. Now, in the South, they would grow their own vegetables. If the owners of the land, these are sharecroppers. These aren't owners of these cabins. These are sharecroppers. They would grow vegetables. And if they were lucky, they had pigs. Otherwise, they didn't have meat. And this guide who was in the Sharecroppers Association, a person of color who dealt with what we call the Black Belt in the South, started asking him about, well, what do they eat for meat? And the answer was, the boss man, the owner of the plantation, said it was bothering his cotton crops. They couldn't raise pigs anymore. Okay. This is a picture from 1963. Mississippi remains one of the three poorest states in the United States. Where was the movement active? Look here, you see the dark colored in areas. The Delta, Southwest, it's all in the polka dots, right? And in the Southeast, also polka dots and a few solid counties. We'll get to what happened there in just a second. Okay, we've been buked and we've been scorned. You know other songs from the movement, but this is the theme song of the Mississippi Civil Rights Movement because they lived in fear. The Freedom Rides, you may have heard what happened in Alabama with the burning of with the Anniston bus being burned. There was a problem in Mississippi. One of the documents that I was able to get hold of at the Kennedy Library was the discussion between the Attorney General of the State of Mississippi and Burke Marshall, the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. And there was a whole issue. He said, if the Freedom Riders came through in 1961, he couldn't guarantee their safety. They might get killed. That's the Attorney General of the state of Mississippi. Now, you know what happened in Alabama. Mississippi is exactly the same thing. An agreement was reached between Robert Kennedy and the Attorney General, but it was arranged by James Eastland that when the Freedom Riders came to Jackson, Mississippi, they'd be protected, but they would be arrested. And they were put in jail in the Parchment Penitentiary, which is up in the Delta on the land of Senator Eastland. I laugh because that's where they ended up. Now, what's important about that legally? It was illegal by that time, according to the Supreme Court, to arrest people who were riding on integrated buses and refused to sit in the back. Supreme Court had ordered that's not legal. You can't arrest them under any circumstances. So, who did the arresting? The state police. This guy. Is he protecting you? And we know about this. I showed you the map of Mississippi, the Southeast and the Southwest. Well, this is where the Klan was active, more than other places. Up in the Delta, they weren't that active. They had what was called the White Citizens Councils, which my friend calls the Uptown Klan. They arrested people. They didn't let people vote. But they didn't kill them. The killing was done in Southwest Mississippi and Southeastern Mississippi. And we'll get to that as well. You see in the middle of the dog biting the black demonstrator. Okay, now if you've seen movies about the demonstrations in Birmingham, you know that they use dogs. Well, they use them in Mississippi as well. Attack dogs, police dogs. So I call it Southern hospitality. Another photograph by Danny Lyon. The early movement in Mississippi and the South in general was involved with elders who were largely graduates of serving in the military, World War II, and in the Korean War. And they mentored civil rights workers. They went and they took them and they helped them out and they organized, and some of them were killed. Not much talk about them being murdered, but in 1962, Herbert Lee was murdered by a member of the Mississippi legislature, a white member of the, got off scot-free. And somebody who witnessed it, one of Herbert Lee's neighbors who was present, when he finally decided that he would testify 2 years later, he was murdered. No convictions on that either. This is another poster from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Anybody recognize the people in that? On the left, it's John Lewis. He was the chairman at that point in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. I think the man on the right was Marion Barry, who had also been chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And it's important to understand here, today I mentioned before about the Reverend Barber and the church and being involved in what's going on today. The civil rights movement, from the very beginnings, had close connections with the church. And not the ministers, because the ministers had a problem. If they came out publicly, they'd lose the opportunity to have churches. The women in the Mississippi civil rights movement, women were a major part. It's also the case now in Alabama. What was it, the beginning of the year? Jones won in Alabama, won the Senate seat. And what did he have? Was it 94%, John, of the black women's vote? Something like that. And that's a vote statewide. Black women have always been involved in supporting the fight. Southwest Mississippi. In the center is Bob Zellner, and I talked about him because I mentioned before we started that he was from a white Southern family. And his father was a Klan member, and his grandfather was a Klan member. And Bob, who got to, he studied in Alabama. He got to know the Reverend King. He did research, sociology research, on what was going on in the South. And he was the first white person in the civil rights movement arrested in Mississippi. He almost got killed down there in 1962. But he's still active today, and I'm still in touch with him. Now, this is a significant event. The song is "We Are Soldiers in the Army, Fighting." And what happened was, in 1963, in the spring, Bob Moses, Jimmy Travis, and the field director of the Voter Education Project were riding in a car, and they were chased by a car which had no license plates, and they were fired upon by a white with a submachine gun. Jimmy Travis had a bullet lodged in his neck underneath his spine. Otherwise, he would have died. Who were they trying to kill at that point? They were trying to kill Bob Moses. What did this shooting lead to? It led to all of the civil rights movement, the Southern civil rights movement, coming together in the town where it happened, Greenwood, in the heart of the Delta. And they came together, and the movement moved on from there with a very important event that took place. All of these things, by the way, are documented in letters and things that went on with the government. Because what the government under Robert Kennedy in the civil rights, in the Department of Justice, and Burke Marshall was in contact constantly in correspondence with the civil rights movement. This was a decision made to find out what was going on. And what happened here in 1963, in the winter and then in the spring. If you don't know about cotton picking, it's not done in the winter. Now, if you're a sharecropper, do you have any income in the winter? No. Well, what had been traditionally done was surplus products from the Department of Agriculture were given to places in the South where people had nothing to eat. And Greenwood and the state of Mississippi cut it off. This is at the time in the winter. And the civil rights movement started trucking in food and clothing for the local people. And the movement was spreading into that, the heart of the Delta, coming in from all parts of the state and getting people involved. Now, what would you feel if you didn't have clothing for the cold winter and you didn't have food? Well, you'd be supporting them, even though it was dangerous. One way or the other, you could die from the situation. And there was a whole thing that went on between the Department of Agriculture and the Civil Rights Division and the movement, and this documentation is in my book as well, the new book, because they decided, they threatened the state of Mississippi, if they didn't renew the supply of food, then the government would directly send the food in to the people. And Greenwood became the center at that point in 1963 of the civil rights movement. But do you think Mississippi let go at that point? No, they didn't. They didn't. And this is what happened. But they So as the spring went on and the attack on the movement increased, Medgar Evers, who had been the field secretary for the NAACP in Mississippi and Jackson, was assassinated. And Medgar Evers was not young. He was in his, I think, his 30s, if not in his 40s. I'm not sure exactly. But he had three children. He was shot with a high-powered rifle when he came home from being involved. And he had been involved in movement activities. Medgar Evers served in World War II overseas, I think in the Far East. And when he was assassinated, you have this march of people, and this is in the black section of Jackson, Mississippi, of people who turned out for the funeral corsage. And what he would do, I've met some of the people that he had mentored. They came from southeastern Mississippi, from the Hattiesburg area. And they're still active today. Two sisters. One is a PhD in sociology from Howard, and she was the head of the department there. And the other one is her sister, Dory. They would be driven from southeastern Mississippi to Jackson for the NAACP youth movement. And the person who did that was Vernon Damer, who had a farm and hosted civil rights workers. In the end, he was also killed by the Klan in 65. But we'll get there as well. So we had June, and we have the March on Washington. What do you know about the March on Washington? Martin Luther King's speech? Do you know that John Lewis tried to give a speech that they wouldn't let him give? That was a speech where he said they would go through the South like Sherman's March. He couldn't get that speech out. He's still fighting. So that's 63 August. Okay, here we have the way I got involved. Freedom vote. Any idea of what a freedom vote was? Could black people register to vote in Mississippi? No. Well, the civil rights movement in the fall of 1963 established what was called a freedom vote. They set up in all their offices all over the state of Mississippi and created paper ballots, which included the Republican and Democratic candidates for the governor's office and a black and a white slate of the civil rights movement. And over 70,000 people registered to vote. Now, how did I get involved? Well, students from Yale and from Stanford went down to Mississippi. I didn't go down for whatever reason. I worked behind the scenes. I worked with the Yale Daily News, and we would get the stories for 3 weeks, called into the Yale Daily News every night. And there was one of the young men at the news who knew shorthand. He took down the stories, and we set them in type, and printed it out, and I spent hours on the phone calling those stories around colleges, to colleges, the Collegiate Press Service down in Philadelphia, Harvard, Cornell, Dartmouth, and I did something else. I got the story on the United Press International Wire Service. Now, do you know what a wire service is? You know Associated Press and Reuters, right? Well, how do stories get out onto the wires? Local reporters record them. Stories weren't coming out of Mississippi. You see the Student Voice, that was the newspaper of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. That's one way. Also, the Mississippi Movement had what was called a wide area calling service. And they paid the telephone company to make unlimited calls. They paid a monthly fee. So they called the stories around the country. And I, up at Yale, did the same thing. And I got the story called into the Hartford Courant. And they inquired on what went on in Mississippi for the day. And they put the whole story out on the wire. I got so involved that by the end of the first semester, I left for a year. I got so involved, I had to leave. I wasn't asked to leave, I just went, and that's when I went to work with the Congress of Racial Equality and working with them, organizing and doing community relations. But the Freedom Vote was a result of that. Now, I'm sure you've heard of Freedom Summer, but before you get there, Hattiesburg, Mississippi. The first Freedom Day, you saw the picture on the cover of my first book on the steps of the courthouse, which is there. That's another picture from that same day. In Hattiesburg. And what followed Freedom Day? Well, all spring there were Freedom Days in various places in Mississippi. Freedom Summer. So I mentioned Dory Ladner before. Lawyer, Oscar Chase. He was a law student at New York University. The Civil Rights Movement had law students and it had lawyers. And they had a great deal of involvement in what was going on in the South because they were in constant contact with the Civil Rights Division. And even in one of the cases, and that's another document in my book, they sued Robert Kennedy and J. Edgar Hoover for not protecting civil rights workers. I've recently had questions about what's going on with immigration, and people at one of the conferences I was at said, well, nobody's doing anything. Immigrants are being attacked by ICE and arrested and so forth and so on. Nothing's happening in the legislature. And I said, well, in the civil rights movement, we had our own lawyers, and we brought cases, and we did what was necessary, and the government followed up on it. And this is what I found at the Kennedy Library. There's all this correspondence, letters from the movement, from the leaders, from the line people, the staff. All this documentation is at the Kennedy Library. Also on what they were doing in other places. So Bob Moses that day was arrested. Oscar Chase was arrested, and he was beaten in the jail. But nothing was done out on the street. Why? Because white ministers and newspapermen were out on the street during the Freedom Day. And this was the last thing they wanted, was the publicity. Anybody know what day they were murdered? First day of Freedom Summer by the Klan from southeastern Mississippi. First day of Freedom Summer. And I mentioned Vernon Dahmer. He was murdered later. But that's it. And if you look at the delta up in the left side, the upper left side of the map of Mississippi, that's the delta. 5 congressional districts in Mississippi. Now, in 1965, you know, there was a Voting Rights Act. And a majority of people of color in Mississippi were... majority lived in the Delta, got the vote. What did the state of Mississippi do? Look at the new districts. They split the district into 3 parts. How long did it take to get that reconstituted? Until 1981. In 1981, it was reconstituted to what it had been before 1966. Okay, if you want a source for all this material, you can take notes here, because these are websites that make information available. All websites that I've used. I have a short biography on the first one, the Civil Rights Movement Veterans Organization, and also the one down at the bottom, which is a Mississippi Civil Rights Veterans Organization. But all of these websites provide information and not just on Mississippi. When you look in the center, you'll see teachingforchange.org and zineducationproject.org. They address issues of civil rights generally, not just the civil rights movement per se from the 60s, but they're constantly updating it with materials which are valuable. I'm now open for... any questions you might have?
I was wondering if it were possible that the person who put the legislation or like the compromise in place was able to get like a profit from it. So if they were like, you know, arrested and they weren't able to be bailed out, or were they able to be bailed
out? Well,
they were
put in the wing of Parchment Penitentiary, which was for serious criminals. They didn't work. But James Eastland, senator, head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, use prison labor from Parchment Penitentiary on his plantation. Now, another, the House of Representatives in their agricultural committee, the head of that was also from the Delta. And he was the one who decided who got cotton allotments. Now, what we know about the South then and to probably some degree today, depending on where you're talking about, congressmen make decisions about how money is allocated from the government. Mississippi, Louisiana get more from the government than they pay taxes. I suspect that that's the case in other states as well, depending on whether they have enough population. That's the best answer I can give you as far as that's concerned. Yeah.
Did you find correspondence or artifacts about the censorship of King's speech at the March on Washington?
Yeah, they knew about it because a bishop in Washington was the one who directed John Lewis to tone down his speech. Now, were the Kennedys in touch with the Catholic administration in Washington? I'm sure. But John Lewis's speech was very radical. Very radical. Justifiably so. If you pay attention to these dates, 61, 62, 63, they were all happening at the same time. And in addition, it happened in Alabama. That's what I'm doing research on at this point, the movement in Alabama at the Kennedy Library. And it's the same thing. They knew in the government. The Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, Burke Marshall, gave reports twice a week to Robert Kennedy. Now, what I didn't mention, but there's a whole chapter on the Civil Rights Commission's holding hearings in Mississippi. They wanted to hold the hearings in 1962. They weren't held until 1965. After Robert Kennedy left office because he stopped them being held. I have the whole correspondence between the Civil Rights Commission and Robert Kennedy on holding up these hearings. And other documentation. I mean, it's all documentation that is valuable to answer questions that we always had in the movement. Why weren't hearings held? Why weren't people being protected? Why did we have to go to the court and sue Robert Kennedy and J. Edgar Hoover? Well, enough has come out now. It took a long time. But the documentation was there. Other questions? Yeah.
From your own experience, like, you know, traveling down there and stuff, what would you say was it like interacting with people, like, you know, like sharecroppers and getting their stories? Do you feel like it was hard for them to, like, you know, trust you, you know, like as a white person, or do you find like it was just fine?
First of all, I'm very white. And I went into the Delta. But I went with someone who was known there. Mm-hmm. Now, this is, you can't go into a place like that and speak with people because, well, you call me whatever you want to call me, Mr. Charlie or whatever. I'm white. Mm-hmm. And it took time to break down the barriers because during the years from 62 on, white people began to get involved, white Southerners, not just Bob Zillner, who I'm personally friendly with until today, and he's still active, but other white people as well. But they were threatened constantly. And poor black people in the Delta who were struggling to survive, to trust me? No. No way. I mean, I was there to observe. I wasn't there to ask questions. But one of the things that the Delta being a source of cotton, you go down there and even today, the soil is so rich. Yazoo is the name of the river on the eastern side of the Delta. On the west is the Mississippi. Now, that those rivers bring the soil down and it goes in. And that's where cotton was grown, because the soil was so rich. And here you have the majority of people in the Delta were people of color. And they remain so. Up until today, there is not one person of color who holds a statewide office in Mississippi. They're in the state senate, they're in the state legislature, but not a statewide office. None. Thank you for coming.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You just heard a lecture by author James Marshall titled The Mississippi Civil Rights Movement, 1960 to 1964. Tonight's lecture was presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program, and tonight's moderator was Boston University Professor of History and African American Studies, John Thornton. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Lee Shuna and Edward Thomas Mazulis. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us. We'll be right back.